Good evening. I'm Ryer Gardenswartz, and this is Aspen Public Radio's broadcast of the 2019 McCloskey Speaker Series. Coming up, Constructing and Deconstructing the Myths of the Bauhaus. Featuring Barry Bergdahl and Meyer Shapiro, professor of art history at Columbia University and curator in the Department of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. Bergdahl will address the Bauhaus's impact on modernist design, which reached far beyond the provincial German cities of Weimar and Dessau, where the school primarily made its home. The Bauhaus's creative use of publications and exhibitions broadcast its philosophy and amplified its achievements. For example, its exhibition in 1923 showed off student work and harnessed a panorama of European modernism by associating works of architects from the Netherlands to the U.S. with the work of its students and masters. Reality and myth began to fuse in the perception of the Bauhaus, when, in fact, no architectural instruction was offered until a few years later. Bergdahl will distinguish the school from the propaganda machine and the reality from the myth. Support for this broadcast of the Aspen Institute's McCloskey Speaker Series comes from Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at pennycarruth.com. You can also find this discussion on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Aspen Institute's forum, Bauhaus, the Making of Modern. We're very happy to have you with us. And this program is in collaboration with the McCloskey series. So Bonnie and Tom McCloskey, thank you for all the series you give us and for partnering with us on this one. Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus movement, said, "We need a new man for a more new humane society." And with that, he gave us the power and the inspiration to be both inspirational, disruptive, as well as constructive and creative, to draw light from darkness. For the last year, all of us here in the Aspen community have been celebrating the Bauhaus movement, in part because one of the great acolytes of the Bauhaus movement, Herbert Beyer, brought those ideas here and made them manifest on this campus. I can't recognize Herbert Beyer without recognizing that it was really the genius of Walter Pepke and Elizabeth Pepke who invited him here to use his beautiful landscape as his canvas to execute those ideas. So we owe much to them as well. This afternoon, we're pleased to have with us one of the foremost scholars, art historians, and most profound experts of the Bauhaus, Barry Bergdahl, who for a number of years served as the chief curator at MoMA for architecture and design, and with another colleague, Leah Dickerman, who's here with us, curated one of the most robust exhibitions, Bauhaus, 1919 to 1933, Workshops for Modernity at the Museum of Modern Art. Barry, we're very happy to have you with us.
Thank you so much for this invitation. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I spent the afternoon playing a little bit of hooky to look at the Herbert Beyer buildings, and I regret that I've never been here before because I suddenly thought of a whole other topic that I'd like to discuss with you, but it intersects with what I want to talk about tonight, which is how extraordinary these buildings are, in my view, related to American architecture of the period. So this goes right to the heart of what I want to say, because in my mind, these buildings are as American as they are Bauhaus German. And that goes to the problem of where we are today, celebrating the 100th birthday of a school that barely made it into adolescence. So this is a very interesting problematic for us, Today we speak of Bauhaus architecture. There's a new book in the bookshop here with that title. We speak of Bauhaus design. We speak of Bauhaus style. We speak of the Bauhaus movement. And yet the Bauhaus was a school that I hope to show you briefly was so complex and so in many ways ever-changing and experimental and resistant to the notion of being captured in something that would be universalizing like a style, a movement, or some notion that Bauhaus architecture would be immediately recognizable. I suspect that if Walter Gropius were still alive, that was a birthday cake stolen off of Rob Wiesenberger and the Harvard Art Museum's brilliant website on the Bauhaus and its history in America. That was the birthday cake that was made for Walter Gropius. Have you recognized the aerial view of the Dessau buildings reconstructed here only to be cut by Gropius's knife? But I think that if Gropius were here today, he would hope that the legacy of that building didn't look anything like that building. The school had been continuously experimental, continuously changing, and I think that everyone who went through it was committed to that idea. So I should say, those of you who would like to have a Bauhaus 101, that is so brilliantly done downstairs in the small exhibition downstairs, absolutely wonderfully intelligent. All the key documents are there, and in many ways it avoids all of the myths that were constructed over the, let's say, the 86 years that the Bauhaus didn't exist but had a very checkered history and now. So there is a beautiful lesson in what some of us have been discussing in this wonderful seminar here at the Institute. So I'm not so much going to go over that. We are in an absolute flurry of activity. This is a very small selection of what you might find. You can hardly go anywhere without discovering a poster for a Bauhaus exhibition or an event, and very often related to the place where it is being staged. As we speak, two new buildings have been completed, Bauhaus Museums. This goes already to the problem of the multiplication of Bauhauses, so we can't really speak about Bauhaus in the singular, even though Gropius did not invent the plural of this neologism that he came up with in 1919. On the left, the one in Weimar, very poignantly, right next to the Gau Forum, a Nazi construction, a place for Nazi parades. And I'm, over the course of the half an hour that's been allotted to me, I'm afraid we're going to discover the Bauhaus being a very politicized event. And some of those events will probably resonate with what we're living through right now. So the decision, the rather brave decision, to place a Bauhaus museum next to the parade grounds of the political movement in Germany that led to its demise is very poignant. Next to it, the new building in Dessau, the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin, the third new museum under expansion, not yet ready, not quite on schedule, but a massive series of exhibitions in Berlin. And of course, everywhere from newspapers to our own gathering here is devoted to thinking in the 100th year of what is the legacy of the Bauhaus. I discovered, because I am interested so much in the architecture of Breuer and Walter Gropius in this country, that the dream of the Bauhaus is alive just outside Pittsburgh. So if you're looking for it, that is the place to go, New Kensington, Pennsylvania, where there is this very interesting defense housing done for the U.S. Government in the Second World War, made out of American wood, supplied to American dimensions, and laid out very casually on the landscape, much as the buildings are here, which is something that you will not find in any Bauhaus location in Germany. So already I want to deconstruct that, but also invite us to think about the complex issue of how these Bauhaus masters, when they began to disseminate across the world after the tragedies of the early 1930s, began to bring their creativity, the principles that they brought with them, to reinvent themselves in new locales. I also want to talk to you very much about something as a historian and curator that interests me, and that is the role of exhibitions at the Bauhaus. And indeed, we're sitting next to a small exhibition and above one there, and exhibitions have played a vital role, not only in keeping the memory of the Bauhaus alive, not only in interpreting it and propagating it, but in a certain sense in what you're going to see in the course of this image-packed presentation, has been a continuous struggle for who owns the Bauhaus. What country does it belong to? But not only that, as you're going to see, in its 14 years, three different directors with very different points of view, both about the school and about architecture and design, and each one of them in some ways leaving Germany with their Bauhaus. Two of them ended up here. One of them was has only recently been captured from oblivion in the Western world, and we'll turn to him briefly. The Bauhaus began the work itself through exhibitions. Now, I'm going to take a rather architecture and design approach to this, not so much the issue of graphic design, although you're going to see beautiful graphics, including the exhibition poster here by Jos Schmidt, and on the right, the square cover for the first Bauhaus exhibition of 1923 in Weimar, designed by our own Herbert Bayer. But the Bauhaus began itself exhibiting what it did. Now, on one level, that would be perfectly innocent. Why would they not want to gather together, invite the public in, show people what they've done, give an understanding of what was going on in this school, particularly in Weimar, very conservative town, very suspicious of these students going through the street in strange dress, smelling of garlic from their participation in Itten's preliminary course, politically maybe not quite aligned with everyone else. And so it was a command by the Weimar government that the Bauhaus prove itself and show off what it was doing. But they mastered from the beginning techniques that we might associate just a few years earlier with the Soviet Revolution of complete propaganda, knowing how to distribute the information everywhere. Even if you neglected to go to see the exhibition, you could not walk through the train station, through the streets of Weimar without encountering various posters. Some of them would be continually updating as the opening kept being delayed. Or, in fact, maybe even receiving in the mail, and these are downstairs, some of the 20-some postcards that were created, each one different and each one by an artist, faculty member for the most part, some students at the Bauhaus. The one on the lower left records a building we'll see in a moment, the House on Horn, a demonstration house of a new kind of living, a radical new kind of living. It's always a good technique to get people to an exhibition is to create a full-scale building that is a commentary on how one might live. Everyone likes to look at other people's houses, and the Bauhaus understood this as a real calling card to get people into the exhibition. The exhibition presented in a very clear way, and I'm not so much going to show that, the pedagogical techniques of the Bauhaus. It showed how the preliminary course worked. It showed a lot of student work. It showed teachers' work as well. They weren't called teachers. They were called masters, as well as demonstrating how the various workshops, this new idea of the Bauhaus, functioned. So it explained both the pedagogy of the school and also showed these products and projects that were so radically different from things people were used to seeing in art exhibitions in Germany at the period. That is very well documented downstairs, so I'm not so much going to show you that part of the exhibition, relatively straightforward and not that different from any school's exhibitions except for the content of what was on display in very traditional vitrines and the like. What was radically new was the emergence with this exhibition of a, we might call it a philosophy of the exhibition, of a notion that exhibition design itself was a practice of art and architecture and design and the Bauhaus's notion of their integration. So gradually the work of designing exhibitions themselves as temporary environments, as places of enormous influence, became a Bauhaus specialty. So that by the time they moved to the second location, which we'll see shortly, in Dessau, exhibition design was a regular part of their activities, not something simply for the demand of a large-scale exhibition. So they reworked the Van de Velde building, which they had inherited, trying to make it their own. Herbert Bayer, at this point still a student, designing that set of course, you all recognize the primary shapes and the primary colors of the three landings of the staircase. Even more dramatic, Walter Gropius redid one room in the building, his own office, not a corner office, as you see, but one that he tried to make much more spatially complex, rendering it in perhaps that hard-to-read axonometric with its colors was reproduced in the catalog so that you could understand it as an architectural project quite different from the late Art Nouveau architecture of the building that he inherited. But he also showed off various works from the workshops and the furniture and the rug in the foreground by Gerd Arndt in the incredible lighting device, and how they were all speaking to one another. So his office was thrown open for kind of open house day. Perhaps most impactful for people was this house am Horn. This was a big debate. Gropius would have liked to have designed it himself. And despite the fact that, as you, I think, all know, the Bauhaus means literally building house, and Gropius was keen that architecture was the unifying concept to which all of the activities of the arts, this melding of fine arts and the useful arts of the applied arts, were aiming. In fact, the Weimar Bauhaus never taught architecture formally inside of its own walls, and most of the architectural work that we associated with it was either done with by young architects who came to work with Gropius in his architectural office in the Bauhaus, since there were no architecture students, and the house am Horn, much to his disappointment, was not executed by any of them, but by the painter Georg Mücke. In my view, I will be a little bit polemical here, it is a totally ham-fisted piece of architecture. It was meant to demonstrate the possibility of prefabrication, the desire for industrialization, but is in fact a traditional brick and stucco building meant to look like what might come out of a stripping down of detail if prefabrication were possible. Much more interesting was the display of Bauhaus work in the interiors. And in particular, one of the most exciting rooms, which was the children's playroom adjacent to the kitchen, which had been outfitted by a woman student, Alma Buscher-Siedhoff, with this extraordinary, you see it in color on the right, this extraordinary set of furniture that was transformable by the children. This in itself is interesting because the idea of children as being innocent and putting in their hands as a kind of Froebel kindergarten concept, basic forms and allowing them to play with them is given to them not only in blocks and in toys, but in actual furniture that they can rearrange, down to a cupboard door that opens to become a puppet theater, and inspiring the inventiveness of young children, even as the Bauhaus was trying to inspire the inventiveness of the late teenagers, who were the principal students. But the one thing I want to really emphasize is the architecture exhibition. Here is where we get into a very paradoxical situation. I just told you that the Bauhaus hadn't trained any architects. There was no student work whatsoever to show at an architecture exhibition. But you're coming to the Bauhaus. You're supposed to see architecture. So we have the Georg Mücke, the painter's house, with the wonderful products from the woodworking furniture workshop. But the architecture exhibition announces the Bauhaus's other ambition, which is to be a clearinghouse, a kind of central nodal point, a network for European-wide, even beyond avant-gardes. So this is a display. We're looking at the first bay, where the work is actually from the Bauhaus, but not by students. Oops, sorry. This is a project for Bauhaus. A housing settlement, this we'll look at in a moment, is by a young Hungarian who's working with Gropius, but is not a student at the Bauhaus. This is Gropius's own designs for prefabricated modular housing, and these are some other Bauhaus-related projects. Over here, we get Dutch architecture, we get Eric Mendelssohn, we get Frank Lloyd Wright, we get Le Corbusier. We get an array of architecture from that was admired at the Bauhaus. So this, I think, is a key. This is a birth moment of a problem that we live with today, which is the Bauhaus, which at this point has produced virtually no architecture, is in the process of becoming a synonym for modern architecture, even though most of what it is showing has germinated in completely different national situations. Even more paradoxical so these are for the grown-ups. We saw the toys for the kids. These are Gropius's so-called Baukasten, or building blocks, a system to show how a prefabricated set of elements could produce a great variety of building, even if it was created industrially in a factory. So you can see how different the house am Horn is from that aesthetic. Very similar in some ways to what was going on in ceramics. This is Bogler working, like some of the others in the ceramics workshop, to create a system of ceramics with reusable parts for different elements. Not all the architecture, moreover, was black and white. This notion of white architecture. Oops, I'm sorry, I'm really inept with this. This is the thing I want. I wanted to show you this is a drawing that we found at the Museum of Modern Art after we closed the exhibition that Lee and I did. That's a very long story. Vibrant Red House by Farkas Molnár, proposed as a ideal. You see how radically different that is from with its Bauhaus-designed garden and like. Nothing like what Bayer will do once he comes to the Rocky Mountains. But so you see that many of the things that we think of about Bauhaus architecture, once we get a color view of this exhibition, are themselves not quite right. Most astounding is this entrance lobby to the exhibition, right near Gropius's office. And here was exhibited work, of course, by Gropius himself, including here a model and images of the project that he had sent to Chicago as an entry in the Chicago Tribune Tower. This came out of his office. It had nothing whatsoever to do with people at the Bauhaus. And most astoundingly, what you see here. What you see here are models now long lost of the architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. Ludwig Mies van der Rohe at this point has absolutely no relationship whatsoever to the Bauhaus. He's part of other avant-garde circles in Berlin. Maybe this is a kind of peace offering because Gropius had staged an exhibition shortly before the founding of the Bauhaus called the Exhibition of Unknown Architects in the Berlin Gallery. It was a rallying point, a first attempt to bring together various people and say, this is the avant-garde. And the young Ludwig Mies submitted this project, and Gropius rejected it. He said, that's not modern architecture. That's a bourgeois traditional villa, rather classical. We're not trying to do the Greeks. We're trying to do an architecture that responds to the materials of our time. You can see how radically different Mies is with his glass and concrete projects here, one a tower, the other a horizontally extruded office building. But that Mies has been admitted in is a momentary attempt to reconcile the lifelong uncomfortableness between these two figures. So there we have someone who comes from a completely different tradition, doing his own photo montage at a time when photo montage is just beginning to be explored in the Bauhaus. That's for that project. If we keep going forward, the drawing that we have at the Museum of Modern Art for that lost model. This activity of, in a certain way, gathering together, or if we wanted to be rude, appropriating, or we should say maybe being inspired by, a very vast array of activity in architecture continues with one of the great publicity machines of the Bauhaus, and that is the creation of this extraordinary series of books, the Bauhaus Bücher. Now, the Bauhaus book series is an absolute monument of modern graphic design, but it also continues a German tradition of book series. There were popular book series called the Blue Books with many different titles, so it is in a kind of publishing tradition. But the Bauhaus therefore decides, even once it's been forced to relocate to industrial Dessau, even once Gropius is able to build these radical new buildings, I took this aerial view because it shows you what a contrast to the architecture that was relatively recent at the edge of Dessau, and you see these kinds of postcards immediately. So the image of the Bauhaus is going to circulate at the same time as the Bauhaus in Bauhaus book number one, put together by Walter Gropius, will bring together architecture that is approved of from around Europe. A lot of it Dutch, Czech, Polish, looking around. And in fact, an international array of architects was invited to the Bauhaus building for its festive openings in 1926. So this desire to be a gathering point for the international avant-garde in architecture, even though it would not be until a year after this building opened in 1926, in 1927, that the Swiss architect Hannes Meyer was called to open up an architecture department and finally begin architectural instruction for the students enrolled in the school. This notion of spreading the idea, of course, soon led to an incredibly designed broadside Bauhaus sort of magazine newsletter. It led also to inviting a commercial filmmaker. The Bauhaus didn't seem to have the ability yet themselves, although they're fascinated with film as the modern mechanical way of making images. But Walter Gropius's house itself would be the subject of a film on the new living, in which I'm sorry, not as good as my colleague Dietrich Neumann, who would have embedded the film itself in there, and you would have seen Isa Gropius, the wife of Walter Gropius, demonstrating the wonders of her house and serving tea to a visiting friend with Bauhaus tea products and the like, and a complete Bauhaus total environment. So a wonderful world of propaganda. A little bit weird because, of course, the tea is being poured by a servant, so many of the people who are supposed to be addressed might not have the full range of equipment that the director involved. But I think I've shown you between book series, this newsletter publication, postcards, and the making of movies that the Bauhaus was getting the message out. At the same time, pulling the European avant-garde in as a kind of clearinghouse, and I said it's sort of networking, and redistributing it. 1928 is a key date for us because in 1928, many of the key figures of the first phase of the Dessau Bauhaus, it's extraordinary, this Bauhaus, it lasts for 14 years, it has at least four different phases. Let's say phase one of Dessau, which is the Gropius years. 1928, Gropius resigns. Beyer and Breuer follow him. So three of the key personalities have left. I want to insist on this. The new director will be Hannes Meyer, and I want to show you three frames in rapid succession. Because by 1930, which is going to end the short, stormy two-year period of Hannes Meyer's complete recasting of the curriculum and even the look of the Bauhaus, by that time we're circulating in Europe exhibitions in which the three successive directors of the Bauhaus were involved in one way or another. So we're now going to enter the world in which Walter Gropius, Hannes Meyer, the second director, and then when he is chased out by the government of Sachsen-Anhalt, by the rising National Socialist Party in that province, he's replaced by Mies van der Hoe. So all of them have an exhibition by 1930, 1931, and they look radically different. They all emphasize the importance of exhibitions, but it would be hard to say, would the real Bauhaus please stand up? So this is our friends. They're all going to make their way soon to America. Gropius, Herbert Beyer, Marcel Breuer, all working together, Moholy-Nagy as well. Moholy-Nagy also leaves in 28. In the Grand Palais in Paris, making something that looks nothing like that Beaux-Arts extravaganza, in a series of rooms that are meant to show the new living. I'm not showing those rooms. And then one architecture and design room. This is an exhibition of the German Werkbund. It is often referred to as a Bauhaus exhibition. It was not a Bauhaus exhibition. The people involved had left the Bauhaus. The organizing sponsor was a completely different organization. But what is front and central in Herbert Beyer's brilliant kind of panorama or cone of vision exhibition design? This is, in a way, the culmination of his emergence as a brilliant exhibition designer. What is front and central? A newly commissioned model of the Bauhaus buildings in Dessau, even though none of these people is any longer associated with that. And then this absolutely brilliant idea to show serial production of chairs by Breuer by hanging them on the wall as objects identical. Why would you exhibit four of the same thing if you didn't want to come up with a visual metaphor for serial production? During the same time, Hannes Meyer, the new director, has put together a traveling exhibition which will go to a whole host of venues. I think you can see immediately that both as an exhibition designer and the type of furniture that he wants the Bauhaus to produce, this very efficient, affordable, collapsible, highly functional, we so associate functional with Gropius and Beyer, although Breuer's chairs were much too expensive for most people. Hannes Meyer tries in a certain way to make good on that functionality, and this traveling exhibition travels around Europe for a number of years. There's Hannes Meyer in a standard Bauhaus pose of putting your hand to the camera shortly before his time at Dessau comes to an end. Here we have the call to the Bauhaus, a very different personality, Ludwig Mies van der Hoe. He's going to arrive late in 1930. While he's there in 1931, he'll be the director from 1930, and it will be he who closes under pressure from the Nazis the Bauhaus in its last fitting attempt at survival in a telephone factory in Berlin once it was chased from Dessau. Survived for about 14 more months in Berlin. But he had already in Berlin done a demonstration of what he viewed, as the new architecture here in the Berlin Building Exhibition of 1931. He called various architects together to show a unity of architectural style among people who were associated with the Bauhaus or not. These are the twin houses designed by him and his partner and sometimes lover, Lili Reich, in Berlin. So, of course, the Bauhaus students went to see it, but it is not, properly speaking, Bauhaus architecture, even though from this time on, architecture will be the dominant activity, along with photography, at Mises Bauhaus. So, what is Hannes Meyer doing during this period? Hannes Meyer is shortly off with a bunch of very left-leaning Bauhaus students, the so-called Red Brigade, to Moscow, where he exhibits adjacent to a school which one might argue, if we were seeing this from the Soviet rather than from the American perspective, was every bit as experimental, important, and influential, and in fact trained thousands of more students, the Soviet Vyhutamas that you see here on this screen. This is the Bauhaus exhibition that the Red Brigade managed to get together in Moscow in 1931. So here we have, even before the Cold War has been declared, Gropius Bayer-Breuer in Paris in the West, and Hannes Meyer and others in Moscow. So we would have a completely different line when we get to the émigrés if we were to follow those who went east rather than those who went west. The story we know, particularly because that west really transformed this valley with these wonderful buildings and this vibrant institute, is very much the line that you see represented there on the left. Now, the fate of Hannes Meyer and everything that went left is going to begin to be edited out rather radically even before the Bauhaus was closed in 1933. This activity seems to have already begun at Harvard, and even before the arrival of Walter Gropius in this exhibition put together by the Society for Contemporary Art. This was a I'm unfortunate that Nicholas Fox Weber couldn't be here with us because he's written on this in his book, Four Apostles. But this was a student exhibition society, and they staged the first ever exhibition of the Bauhaus in the United States. It then traveled to a gallery in New York and on to Chicago. It's beautifully documented on the new website that I keep advertising, because we're getting into advertising here, on the Harvard Art Museum site, from which I stole also this. But I want you to notice that this was an exhibition in December 1930, carried into 1931, that showed the Bauhaus only in its early phase. So we begin the process of editing Hannes Meyer and sometimes even Mies van der Rohe out of the history of the Bauhaus. The protagonists here are very well known because they are the group that is going to give us the architecture and design activities of the Young Museum of Modern Art, founded in 1929. You see all three of them here. They had all visited the Bauhaus. They were all very excited by it. The future director of the Museum of Modern Art, Alfred Barr, there, he had gone to the Bauhaus already in 1926, and he referred to, sorry, in 1927, and he referred to that trip. He said, I regard the 3 days that I spent at the Bauhaus as the most important days of my architectural education. He's standing next to Philip Johnson, who would go repeated times, and in fact, Philip Johnson, we're going to see, very important in the acquisition of the Schlemmer painting. Philip Johnson, who himself thought for a time to study art history or architecture in Germany. There they are on vacation. So frequent visits. The other protagonist here is Henry Russell Hitchcock. Here we see him at the opening of the Bauhaus exhibition that we're going to get to in a moment, 1938. And Hitchcock had already lectured on the Bauhaus at Wellesley College in the first ever course on modern art in the United States. Together, they will produce this infamous, famous, influential exhibition and its catalog, and then this accompanying book that defines the concept of the international style, architecture since 1922, and the Bauhaus will play a very important role there. But I juxtapose it, of course, with Hannes Meyer in 1931, so with the exhibition catalog from Moscow. So I need to pick up the pace here. We're going to get into some very familiar material. The famous 1932 show, known as the International Style Show, though that was not the title. And here we are in the Bauhaus room. You recognize that model that has come from Paris. Unfortunately, they didn't yet bring Herbert Bayer, so Philip Johnson installed it with a little skirt, hung all the photographs on the wall in a straight line. Straightforward, rather amateurish exhibition design. The exhibition itself, in fact, took place up on an upper floor of this building. What a contrast, right, in terms of exhibition design between that model as Beyer installed it and that model as Philip Johnson and Henry Russell Hitchcock and Barr installed it. Two documents, one 1936, the cover of Barr's seminal Cubism and Abstract Art. I bring it in as an eye test for you. Can everyone see when modern architecture came into existence? Because if you can, your prescription is correct. Right here in 1925, during the construction of the Bauhaus, when Purism, de Stijl, and I can't read it from here, off, and the Bauhaus flow into modern architecture. At least there are three confluences coming together. Very quickly, there's going to become the possibility of replacing the word modern architecture with Bauhaus, although, of course, by 1936, the Bauhaus itself has been deceased by 3 years. At the same time, I bring in this page from the Museum of Modern Art guestbook. We can only assume that not everyone who attended was allowed to sign in, because it looks actually like the guest book of the Bauhaus in Dessau. We have Moholy-Nagy, we have Herbert Beyer, we have Marcel Breuer. We don't have Gropius, I don't think, unless I can't read it from here, because he was too busy installing the 1938 Bauhaus exhibition. This exhibition is so nicely detailed for you downstairs. I want to just make one point of it with you. Of course, it was not in the building that we know so well. It was not yet here. That didn't open until a year later. Rather, it was in the shopping concourse, we're still in the late Depression, of the Rockefeller Center. Not all of the shops were rented, so the Museum of Modern Art was given this as temporary quarters, and Herbert Beyer brilliantly designed the exhibition, putting the model as though it were for sale in the sales window of the Museum of Modern Art with this amazing design. That is so beautifully documented downstairs that I'm sending you there for what I don't have time to tell you. But I just want to point out to you, here's the invitation to the exhibition. Further, all of the graphics done by Beyer, the exhibition design done by Beyer. But we have to think of this exhibition, which was originally planned to open in 1937 and then was delayed till 1938, as the U.S. response to the degenerate art exhibition staged by the Nazis. So these are artists, all of these Bauhaus artists, are artists now in America who would have been degenerate had there been an architecture and design section of the infamous degenerate art show. So it's important to remember that in the context of the reception of this show. Interesting to think of these two buildings going up, the House of German Art, today the House of the Haus der Kunst in Munich, built for Nazi exhibitions, and the Museum of Modern Art, perhaps pushed to a greater modern expression, not only by the ideology of the Museum of Modern Art, its aesthetic point of view, but I think also by the beginning of the emergence of the association of modern architecture, whatever its origin, but increasingly the work of these displaced people who had fled Nazi Germany as the architecture of the Free West. So the beginning of the association of the Bauhaus architecture with the emergence of the Cold War. Bauhaus staircase purchased by Philip Johnson for the Museum of Modern Art, first for himself and then for the Museum of Modern Art, as a, in a sense, a retaliation for the Nazis having closed Schlemmer's exhibition. That is something that Leah and others discovered that is detailed in the catalog. John McAndrew, the official curator of this, but the real people working here are Gropius and Beyer. Beyer now brings his exhibition design, and I'm going to flip through this very quickly. I do want to insist on one interesting thing, is that almost nothing in this show came from Europe. The correspondence in the archives of the Museum of Modern Art is fascinating. Beyer was back in Germany in 1937, then he comes over in 1938. He's supposed to act as the coordinator. There are letters that say, please be careful in your correspondence with Beyer. He's an Austrian citizen, and therefore he's a Reichsdeutscher. And be careful of how you refer to this. We're doing a show about design. It has nothing to do with the Bauhaus. Don't mention the word Bauhaus. Letters that go to Switzerland talk about the Bauhaus. So even the correspondence is politicized for trying to bring this together. Of course, none of these paper projects from the preliminary course had made it across the ocean. They were reconstructed by students at Black Mountain College for the exhibition, which went on to, in Gropius's mind, show that the Bauhaus was an educational system rather than a style. And so all of the techniques, the workshops, were there. We see it being photographed as though it was installed by Lucia Moholy-Nagy. But most interestingly about this, when we get to the Bayer-designed catalog, is look at those dates. Bauhaus, 1919, 1928. So the Bauhaus, which was closed in 1933, is now going to have omitted from its American retrospective, post-mortem, if you will, the Hannes Meyer period and the Mies van der Rohe period. So both of those people, for complex reasons, are left out. Mies, I think, just didn't want to be associated with Gropius. He was already in Chicago. Meyer was more problematic. He had this communist overlay. This was not going to play so well in 1930s New York. But despite the fact that the exhibition claims that it ends in 1928, when we start to look at it, not only, of course, is Gropius's work that has nothing to do with the Bauhaus for Chicago, again, there, it's kind of an advertisement, need a skyscraper, I can do one for you, but he also puts in a model of a house that he and Breuer have just completed in their new Cambridge, Massachusetts practice for the parents of a student of the Graduate School of Design, named Haggerty. The Haggerty House at Cohasset, still standing, recently restored, brand new architecture. So the Bauhaus is alive and well in America. Breuer lent his furniture, so he's living for about a year without living room furniture. Some of it has nothing to do with the Bauhaus, includes this aluminum furniture that he made actually in Zurich. And then a very short-lived attempt at a new Bauhaus in New York, the Laboratory School of Design, was invited a couple days before the opening to include a display. So they got this together in 24 hours, very industrious. And he ends with this wonderful, mysterious kind of Times Square gesture. We could, but I'm already running out of time, so I'm going to hop, skip, and jump through the groundwork I've laid, which is the Bauhaus closed by pressure from the Nazis becomes, in its posthumous existence, a complete tool of the Cold War. And we have a sub-story, which is a kind of, I would say, a bit of a conflict between the Bauhäusler in Chicago and the Bauhäusler in the Cambridge-MoMA axis. Maybe that's a little bit of an overstatement. But, of course, Moholy, and this is absolutely key to the origins of the Aspen Institute, Moholy briefly opens the new Bauhaus in Chicago, very much associated with Chicago business. So this, on one level, is a conversation with American business. On the other hand, it's a fulfillment of Gropius's dream that the Bauhaus would have a relationship with industrial production in Germany. Interestingly enough, they set up shop initially in the Marshall Field Mansion on Prairie Avenue. It would rather they stage exhibitions. So again, in America, in the 30s, into the 40s, even into the 50s, we have different visions. Were there more time, we could discuss the vexed issue of the Bauhaus's relationship to advertising. Advertising had emerged in the Dessau Bauhaus as a main activity. Some of the key people in the Bauhaus, Bayer, of course, we think of immediately, were going to go on and have careers in advertising. This was also true for lesser-known figures like Heinz Loaf, who went and had a major career in advertising in England, one of the few Americans to go to the Bauhaus, a man named Edwin Fisher, who then had an advertising career on Madison Avenue. So the relationship of Bauhaus to American advertising, certainly something very well known here with Pepke and Container Corporation, is key. But it raises an interesting question for us that we could debate. What is the relationship of advertising to ideology and opinions? What is the role of somebody who does advertisement, of a Herbert Bayer who can prepare graphics for the Deutschland Ausstellung in National Socialist Germany, and then become an absolutely key, brilliant image maker for the American war effort as the Bauhaus quickly becomes no longer a kind of simply imported Germanness, but America harboring the memory of Weimar Germany and America engaged in the debate and the struggle for democracy. An exhibition history would need to look at, you could follow, we could just write the biography of this model, would be a fascinating thing. Maybe that would have given me a lecture that fit into the time allotted. There it is at Harvard in 1951. It was supposed to be in the permanent collection of MoMA, but Gropius said, MoMA's not interested in the Bauhaus anymore. This is really interesting for us because then there is a period when Gropius feels that America is detaching from the Bauhaus. By our current period, we get back to this sort of thing. I would argue that even though somebody who was engaged with the Bauhaus is represented in every building on that screen, I do not understand why those buildings would be considered Bauhaus buildings. Marcel Breuer designing the heaviest building of his career, and we could go on and on. So simultaneously, the polemicization of the term Bauhaus and its unbelievable elasticity. The people who are going to try to get it back and claim it, and the centennial is absolutely a jubilee moment in this, and the amount of money that the Federal Republic of Germany has poured into the centennial, I think is a continuity of a story that goes back to the immediate post-war period. So here I contrast in the Cold War the whole institutional history of the Bauhaus archive founded by Gropius and Winkler, the writer of the great monumental Bauhaus book in the Federal Republic on the left, and the belated rehabilitation of the Bauhaus as an integral part of the history of East Germany. So by the 1970s, there are two alternative histories of the Bauhaus available in the two Germanies. This has been much studied. You can go even to the site of the Stieglitz 14-month occupation of a long bombed and demolished telephone factory to see this memorial site for the Bauhaus. And here we see Gropius presenting the project for a permanent building for the Bauhaus archive, initially to be built at Darmstadt. The Bauhaus archive had been opened there in the 1960s, curiously enough, in the Matildenhoe, in the Ernst Ludwig house, but they were going to get a permanent building, but the money never came through. There is the design for Darmstadt, 1964, and then this building is recycled, and 1971 they move to the to Charlottenburg into temporary headquarters in an outbuilding of the Schloss Charlottenburg, and then 1976 to 1979, Gropius builds this this building of Gropius's design, but opened, in fact, after his death, is opened in West Berlin. And I just end with 50 years ago, the 50th anniversary of the Bauhaus. Here, the Bauhaus archive, now having constituted an absolutely extraordinary collection in West Germany, since the collections that are today in Weimar and Dessau were largely in East Germany at the time. And that's a whole separate story. So this newly constituted Bauhaus archive, to which many émigrés contributed, went on a huge roadshow. Beyer, again, involved as an exhibition designer, as a poster designer. But this was not exactly the most propitious moment for such an activity, besides the fact that the show circulated for about 3.5 years, by which time many of the objects were very light damaged by their political role in being the ambassadors for the notion that the Federal Republic had cleansed itself of the Nazis and the Bauhaus was going to be the instrument to do it. These are the students protesting Walter Gropius's speech at the opening of the exhibition in Stuttgart at the Württembergisches Landesmuseum, I think. And he needs to take a bullhorn to sound over the protests. They're not protesting Gropius. They are protesting, ironically enough, the closing of the Hochschule für Gestaltung in Ulm, which had been celebrated as the revival of the Bauhaus project in Germany. So this 1968 moment, which is so complex worldwide, is also a very conflicted and complicated moment for the Bauhaus. I'll just end with this image of the fate of the Bauhaus. Will the Bauhaus, as this current exhibition in Ulm, be saved for its institutional heritage and those places which can claim either a genealogical relationship to a Bauhaus master or in some way or another to have discerned underlying Bauhaus principles and to have pushed it forward towards new creation? These are some of the products of Ulm, including the famous Ulm stool. Or this taken from not far away in that part of Germany, one of the many branches of the Bauhaus do-it-yourself. It's a kind of it's a DIY store where you can buy things to do it yourself, there is no imprimatur of a Bauhaus spirit on it. I remember my confusion when I went as a student to Germany and regretted that I couldn't go to Dessau. It was in the middle of the Cold War. I, too, a child of the Cold War. And then see this red sign off the Autobahn. But then I kept seeing it as we approached every other city. So who's going to own the Bauhaus? The institutional memory of the Bauhaus or the commercialization of the Bauhaus? I leave you only with questions to show you how complicated it is, both to discern what was the Bauhaus with its movement in three, four phases, and then who has the right to claim the heritage of the Bauhaus into 21st century design culture. Thank you very much for your patience. I a little overstayed my welcome, but I think there is time for questions. Is that right, for a few? So then I think there was one over here.
Yes. So Mies van der Rohe, during his time in Chicago, would he have associated himself with Bauhaus? You talk about Gropius and Harvard sort of editing out certain phases of Bauhaus, and he certainly becomes known for the international style. But would he, I just don't know, would he have talked a lot about his history with Bauhaus, or was he also interested in separating and creating his own identity and legacy?
Well, I suspect for him the word Bauhaus was a little complicated, because one of the most brilliant, we mustn't forget that it's Gropius who founds the Bauhaus. And although someone brought up that the word Bauhaus, Dietrich Neumann this morning, that the word Bauhaus had actually been used in a different context, so it was available already as a neologism, nonetheless, Gropius so much considered that the word and the place were of his invention that when he left Weimar, the only thing, really, of any substance that he was allowed to take with him, because he left behind the collections, he had the idea already of creating a Bauhaus museum, and was photographing all the students' work. All that stayed behind in Weimar. The only thing that he really left with was the name Bauhaus. He said, you cannot have the name Bauhaus. It belongs to me. So already Bauhaus, in a certain sense, had become a trademark. So I do think that that's also why perhaps Mies, operating in the same country and in overlapping circles, although separated by a couple of hundred miles, might have not been so much wanting to trumpet the Bauhaus. Not that he was ashamed of it, but it wasn't so much of his... he was not the inventor of it. I think you could argue that in some ways, Mies as an architectural educator, there's a much greater continuity between what Mies was teaching at the Bauhaus in its last 3 years and the way he taught at IIT. And there's a much greater continuity, therefore, between very late Bauhaus architecture under Mies and what happens in Chicago with the campus of IIT. Not that that's German architecture, but there's a much greater continuity there. But I don't think for him it was so important to claim the Bauhaus imprimatur for this. So their careers are parallel, and they don't have the same, I don't think that they have the same desire to, even though they're also both educators, the same desire to take credit for the Bauhaus per se. It's a very funny story that Mies' grandson, Dirk Lohan, who's an architect, told me once about Mies arriving at a convention and where he checked into the hotel, and he's maybe been here himself and told this story. He checked into the hotel, and at the reception they said, oh, Mr. van der Rohe, because nobody could ever get his name right, Mr. van der Rohe, it's so wonderful that you're staying in our hotel because Mr. Gropius is also staying here. And Mies and his grandson got into the elevator, and he said, I know, Gropius, he always has his breakfast really early. We're going to get up a little late. You know, I don't feel like talking to Gropius. And so they get up a little late, but Gropius had his breakfast late that morning, and they walk into the elevator, and who's there but Walter Gropius? And so I asked her, well, what did you say? What did they say to each other? The historian thinking gets some vital knowledge. He said, Gropius said, good morning, Mies. And Mies said, good morning, Grope. And that was the end of the conversation. So the tensions and the animosities, despite the peace treaty in 1923, I think never really went away. Any other questions out there? Yeah, all the way in the back.
Could you speak more to how the ideology of the Bauhaus led to the connection to industrial production and advertising? So how did the ideology connect to business, production, looking at monetizing and connecting art and business.
Mm-hmm. So the real rubric that, particularly with the 1923 exhibition that Gropius begins to talk about, is art and industry, a new unity. But we could put business into that formula because, after all, this is industry to feed business. It's certainly not the first example, but it is absolutely an adamant desire to create works of art that have a relationship to the market. There's a lot written on this. This leads to all sorts of paradoxes and conflicts over ownership, over rights, and the like. But I think the key answer to your question is the Bauhaus absolutely welcomed a relationship to business and even thought of the possibility of setting itself up as a business, and that the products of the school could be, not only did they want to conceive designs that could be mass-produced, they therefore were in alliances with nature, with industry. This was already the project of the German Werkbund, who I mentioned in association with the 1930 exhibition in Paris, but which is an institution that went back to before the war, and with Walter Gropius was very involved. So that Werkbund philosophy and ideology and these seeking of alliances between artists, designers, and industry and business was absolutely foundational for the Bauhaus, even in its very early, expressionist phases. So that, I think, is one of the most innovative things of the Bauhaus, is the school that is accepting that the modern condition is a condition of commerce. However, if we had another 2 hours, we could get into some of the extraordinary complexities of it. There's a very famous pseudo-film poster that Marcel Breuer designed for his own chairs and the evolution of the chairs and how he was creating a new one every year. You could read it as the rapid evolution towards a more and more industrialized modern style. You could also read it as a new product line every year. But part of the language on this pseudo-film poster has to do with who owns the rights to that product. By 1928, when he's leaving the Bauhaus, Herbert Beyer has designed a, may even be reproduced downstairs, a cover for a catalog of Breuer's furniture, which you can purchase, which is called Breuer Möbel, Breuer Furniture. So what are the products of the Bauhaus? Are they the collective work of the Bauhaus for which the profits are meant to underwrite the expense of running this school, which also has the ambitions to bring more and more machines in for the students to actually not just think about what industry might look like, but actually work in an industrial manner? I mean, if you think about it, any of you who are related to an architecture school know that one of the chief expenses of an architecture school today is computers and software, et cetera. That's a really heavy investment. Well, this is already in the ambitions of the Bauhaus, not just some hand-carved tools, but really wouldn't it be great to have all sorts of machines? They rarely have the money to do this. So there are all these contradictions, but one of the key contradictions is the Bauhaus creating collective products that are almost going to go on the market anonymously under the tag which was invented, Bauhaus GmbH, or are they going to go out as the product line of Marcel Breuer, of Herbert Beyer, of et cetera? And that continues, in a certain sense, into this country with Walter Gropius' setting up, ultimately, of his architectural practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as the Architects Collaborative. So even the refusal that the architectural office bears anybody's name, it's a collective, et cetera. So, all of that to say that your question goes to the heart of their ambitions, and those ambitions also raised all of the paradoxes of the relationship between an artistic educational institution and commerce and the market. Who told you to clap? Good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a broadcast of the McCloskey Speaker Series. You can also find this discussion on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for this broadcast of the Aspen Institute's McCloskey Speaker Series comes from Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at pennycarruth.com. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.